is 1:05 p.m.
Could you repeat that again? We are recording. It takes a pause.
Okay. The date is 1:05 p.m. on July 20th, 2020, and I am convening this video conference meeting of the Personnel Committee of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act, the governor's suspension of certain Open Meeting Act requirements due to the COVID-19 pandemic and the association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on July 10th, 2020 and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. A copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official minutes of this meeting. A quorum is achieved as all three members of the committee are in attendance. Also in attendance are Board Counsel Shelby Bates, General Counsel Jackie Risen, Executive Director Bart Bowles, and Association Employees Jarrett Terry and Topping Haggerty, and we are also joined by Patty Otto of the TDI.
So Robin, I'd like to make sure everyone can see the briefing material on screen as I'm sharing it.
I see, looks like your desktop picture.
Okay, let me change that real quick. Takes just a second to switch around here. Okay, how's that?
Oh, that looks good. Okay, so first item on the agenda is the consideration and possible action on the consent agenda item, which is the summary of the official minutes of the January 27th, 2020 meeting. Has everyone had a chance to review that, and are there any changes?
Changes, motion to approve.
Second.
Okay, so that's approved. Moving on to item two on the agenda, consideration and possible action on responses to the request for proposals to engage a compensation consulting firm for staff other than the executive director.
And Robin, what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is just to talk a bit about our process and how the information was distributed, and just name the five firms we received. And then as far as discussion of the specific terms of their proposals and the review of the compilation of the individual committee members' evaluations, if we could withhold that until executive session because it is confidential.
Okay.
Okay, so in the materials on 2-1, we do run through that the RFP was distributed on June 1st, and it was sent to, I believe there were 12 firms. I had many back and forth emails with some of those firms just to ask questions and to confirm. Only one specifically said they were going to withdraw, that they weren't interested. But we did then receive by the July 3rd submission deadline, five proposals from the firms you see listed there. Only one of those firms had done a compensation study like this with the association in the past. The other four are new firms to do any work for the association. Although you'll see the first one on the list is a firm we've used, but it's a different area within that firm. You know, they draw these walls between different, whether it be accounting areas or benefits or different types of consulting. So I hope you all had the opportunity to review the proposals, to go through them, and then you've received my compilation of your evaluations. Is there anything you want to ask about the process or the screening that we did to come up with firms? And beyond that, we can save the details of this discussion for executive session.
I don't have any questions.
No comment, but we would like to just thank you, Boyd, for the evaluation guideline and form. I think the for the most part, all of them were very comprehensive. So five responses was, I think, very favorable for us. But the form and the process was extremely user-friendly.
Good. We're glad that worked out for you. We did see one thing we'd like to maybe edit for next time, but we won't talk about that now. So with that, I think we can wait to have the rest of our discussion on item two in executive session. Robin, we're ready to go to item three.
Okay. So item three, consideration and possible action on the benefits provided to the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association's employees, including the insurance plan renewals.
Okay. So these are the non-salary benefits of the association. And what we tried to show you there for each one of the categories, where we've got renewals in from the insurance companies and if they were different. And it's in what I've really focused on are just the differences of the current provider. If they've come back with a difference in rate or a change in their plan and their coverage. So for the health insurance plan, which is provided by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas, there were some changes that they proposed in their renewal plan to increase the individual out-of-pocket maximum from $4,000 to $6,000 for in-network, to change the copay for specialty office visits from $50 to $60, to change the copay on urgent care center visits from $30 to $60, and then the premium increased. Fairly modest increase, around 3%, but there was a small increase. There were no changes to the prescription drug benefits in that plan. Now, in addition to this renewal proposal, we do have proposals from three other carriers that we'll talk about in executive session. The dental insurance plan, which is provided by Sun Life, we received a renewal quote from Sun Life, almost a 20% increase in premium, but the coverage remained exactly the same and the network the same, but just a 20% increase in premium. Long-term disability, which is also provided by Sun Life, they did not change anything in their current rates or their coverage. And the same for the term life and accidental death and dismemberment insurance that Sun Life provides. Same premium rate, same benefits in the quote that they provided to us. We do have for all three of these, being the dental, the long-term disability, term life, and AD&D, those three coverages. We have other quotes from other firms that we'd like to show you in executive session. And the remaining non-salary benefits for the association, the 401k plan, the matching and the vesting schedule is unchanged. The 457B plan is unchanged. The annual accrual of sick leave, vacation leave, and personal leave. I am going to ask you to consider a small change there. At the last committee meeting in January, one of the members, I think this Mr. Huckabee, asked me to explore to possibly look at changing the amount of leave that could be carried over for sick leave at the end of the year. I think right now topping is that, stop me if I'm wrong, 80 hours, is that correct?
Yeah, sick leave 80 hours, vacation leave 40 hours.
Okay, so with 80 hours of sick leave, you're looking at 2 weeks of maximum sick leave carryover, and then if you could accumulate more during the year, but we have a long-term disability period that has a 90-day elimination period. So you have 3 full months. And I think Mr. Huckabee's suggestion is to see if there's a way that a person could accumulate sick leave to possibly bridge the gap from the point they leave, they run out, so they don't run out of leave, and it can carry them through the elimination period when long-term disability could kick in. After some research on the internet, I found that most companies, because sick leave is not reimbursable upon termination from employment, that sick leave carryover is not limited in any way. That any amount that an employee chooses to accrue, wants to accrue, it can be accrued and is never limited. So that would be the change I'd recommend, is we just remove the limitation on sick leave carryover. Questions?
No.
And Jackie, if there's anything from council that you'd like to share in executive session, speak up now.
I don't think I have anything on this, Bart, but thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. Okay, so I will go ahead and just mention our paid holidays, our parking, and our health reimbursement arrangement has not changed. I thought that we might want to look at the health reimbursement arrangement change, because the health insurance, if I go back to this, as you can see, the out-of-pocket increasing, still have the same deductible. But instead of having a $4,000 out-of-pocket, you still have a $6,000 out-of-pocket. So with the health reimbursement arrangement, it's a little bit more of a bite out of the employee's pocket. I have not drafted up any type of proposal. I just wanted to point that out and see if there's anything the committee would like for us to explore with respect to that health reimbursement arrangement.
What is it now? What is the amount of the health reimbursement arrangement?
It's $1,500 a year, but you can carry over 50% of that per year to the next year. And then with the 50% continuing to carry over, you can accumulate up to a maximum of $4,500. So with that $4,500, it theoretically, you could cover your entire $4,000 maximum out of pocket if you had a significant procedure or illness. Today, if we renew our health insurance with a $6,000 out of pocket maximum, someone could get hit with a significant illness or a surgery and have to come more out of pocket, even if they've met their deductible.
Mm-hmm.
How standard is that 50% limitation on the rollover?
You know, that's something I can't tell you, David. And I've looked, but I saw it all across the board. I couldn't find any consistency.
I'm not that familiar with them because we don't offer those at Harris County, but you know, the committee might want to consider allowing people to roll over 100% of the unused portion up to a maximum accrual balance of the 6,000, something that David and James and I might want to talk about doing for next year.
If you'd like us to do a little bit more investigation,
yes,
you're going to have possibly another committee meeting in October. You already definitely have one in January scheduled.
Right.
The health insurance plan was take effect. Its effective date is October 1 each year. The health reimbursement arrangement renews, you know, annually. So we could address these this evening in January with some additional information. We've got plenty of time to think about that.
Okay.
That's good.
Okay. Then we will look at that and come back to you. And here on page 3-4 is a recommended resolution regarding the sick leave carryover limitation.
Okay. So we need a motion on that?
So moved.
Second.
That was Summer first, Huckabee second.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Okay.
All right, so item four, consideration and possible action on the association's employee leave of absence policy.
You know, Robin, we've discussed this several times and gone back and forth. I think this is the fourth meeting we've talked about it, but it's taken a lot of exploration to kind of wrestle this to the ground and find out what are the obligations of the association, and in the absence of obligations, just what makes sense and what's equitable and fair. Immediately after the last meeting, based on some of the comments that were made, Jackie jumped on and made another draft. And Jackie, is this something you can explain your draft in open session?
Yeah, I think I can. And I have to tell you, I was not able to actually find my old version. And so I can tell you, you know, I can't tell you what we looked at in January and exactly what I did to change it. But I think the way it's organized now is that we recognize there are basically three different instances where an employee might be on an extended leave of absence. So the first instance is medical, you know, for the employee or for them to look after an immediate family member with a serious health condition. And so the seven categories are kind of standard things that you would, you know, see for this kind of a policy. Then the next category is the military caregiver leave. And this is for an employee who is, let's see, a little easier. This is for an employee who has, you know, worked for the association for at least a year. And the employee is a member of the armed services, and they need to take care of a spouse, son, daughter, parent, next of kin, who is undergoing, you know, some kind of medical treatment or serious medical treatment. And then the last category is the military service. And this is for someone who is in the military and they are called up to serve. And so they're going to be gone for some amount of time. And then the rest, you know, really the rest of the policy there, a lot of this has to do with the military service leave itself. And then in four, there's how to make the request for leave. Five is the reporting requirements while on leave. Six talks about the benefits while on leave. So health insurance, you know, an employee can continue their health insurance, but they have to pay for the first 12 weeks of leave. The association will pay the employer portion, and then the employee would still pay their portion after 12 weeks, then the employee would have to pay all of it. And then no sick leave or vacation is accrued while a leave is being taken, and the retirement contributions don't accrue either. And then at the end of the leave, you know, for some reason, the employee is not able to come back and do the job that they had before without a reasonable accommodation, then they, you know, would be terminated from employment then. And then there's the last paragraph there about armed services. They have to basically, you know, there's an association that's gonna make an effort to reemploy the members of the armed services, but they may still have to, you know, provide an application for that. So that's pretty much it.
Well, I think that covers everything that we felt like needed to be covered. So, any comments or changes that the committee would like to see before we make a motion?
Just one question about end of leave. If an employee goes on leave and then chooses not to come back, not that they can't, not that they're unable to perform the duties, but they choose not to come back, is there any reimbursement of the healthcare costs that have been paid during their leave, or?
No.
Okay.
No. Is that something you want considered, David?
No, I just was wondering, because I know it's sometimes an issue in FMLA.
Right.
We have that policy here at Harris County, and I've been there 31 years, and as far as I know of, even though it's in our personnel regs that we can seek reimbursement for the benefits that were paid while you were out if you don't come back, we've never done it. So it almost seems silly to have something in a policy plan to enforce it.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I was just curious because I know that's sometimes talked about. Yeah, it looks, I don't know anything about the military part, but the sick leave part sounds, it's modeled identically after FMLA, so.
I think it's good, even though we're not subject to FMLA, it's just right. The benefit that's good for the employees, and hopefully with retention of our employees or attracting new employees, people always look at the benefits, so I think it's great. I think the changes we've talked about over the past year are all incorporated in the draft that we have before us. So if you would accept a motion, Madam Chair, 4.5, the resolution, I move to approve.
Second.
Motion accepted. About a second. David, one of you have a second?
Yeah, I said second. Sorry. Second.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you. Okay. Motion approved. Moving on now to item 5, consideration and possible action on adoption of an education expense reimbursement policy.
This was introduced initially during January, and we had our discussion on it. Good discussion to kind of find out what makes sense, what doesn't make sense for the association. And again, Jackie put some pen to this with what she heard. There were a couple items here. I'll go to here's the first page of the education expense reimbursement policy. And on the second page, you have some options about how much of the expenses will be reimbursed, what percentage, and to what maximum amount. And the rest of it, I think we just cleaned up some of the language a little bit. And then we do have this repayment at the end if termination of the employee terminates service within a certain period after receiving the reimbursement. So that was in the prior form that we provided to you, and that's been retained. So you tell me if you want me to stop on any specific section or you want to go through it. How do you want to consider this?
I think I'd like for us to go through it and, you know, the things where there's options, we could discuss those options, but since it's new, it'd be nice if we just went through it maybe together.
So I will just roll it section by section. I think the lead-in is pretty straightforward. Eligibility. Questions there on an employee, the parameters for when they must, how they are eligible to participate. Then the course eligibility. And I thought it was important to point out here, this has actually got a typo right here, applicable to the employee's current job, future position, the association's field of work, and offered at a time does not interfere with normally scheduled working hours. With our small number of staff, if someone's going to be gone 3 days a week to go to a class or classes, during work hours, it's pretty difficult. So
right.
We can manage, but it's going to take some effort with a small staff, not a lot of coverage.
And will the executive director determine whether something is applicable to the employee's current job or future position?
Yes. It's pretty clear some of the things that are beneficial there. I know what positions are asked to do what.
It's, right. I'll
say it this way. Accounting functions, finance functions, drafting, customer service, interacting with the external facing customers. It's pretty clear job by job. I know the expectations, and if they tell me this is a class, okay, how's it going to help you do X? But I'm not going to be difficult on that, but it's got to be reasonable. It can't be something on herbology or, you know, mechanic, you know, auto repair. That's not going to benefit us. I'll be reasonable. And then I'll try to get all the expenses and limitations on screen here. I think it's pretty clear. Tuition fees and lab fees and books. Other than that, it's really the association is not going to reimburse that. And we'll only pay in-state and we'll only reimburse after they've received a passing grade. The association has not had a policy like this, but we did when LaShelle Kaufman and Bowles was managing the association, and we had a couple of employees that went through and completed their undergrad. And I will tell you, it did benefit us. I mean, their ability to communicate, to write, whether it be for to the external customers or working on documents in-house, significantly enhanced. So I'll stop there for a moment and see if there are questions.
Oh, and I have a question. So eligibility, I have to be employed with the association for 1 year. And I'm looking at the amounts, a max of $5,000 to $3,000 per year. Is there any differential if I've been at the association 12 months and a day versus 5 years? Are we both of us in that example eligible for the same amount of annual reimbursement?
I feel yes. And just once you have to have been an employee for at least a year,
mm-hmm.
you're eligible. And it doesn't increase or decrease after that. And on the eligible expenses and the max, this is intended to show, do you want to reimburse everything or a portion of it? And if so, what portion? And then is there an overall limit? So if you want to consider this policy, we do need to decide on a percentage
right. And
a maximum dollar amount. But any employee that has been with the association more than 1 year is eligible and the amount does not change.
One other question. We had discussed a certification course. If you had a accountant that was pursuing some type of professional certification that's applicable to their job, does this allow for that to occur?
Yes. Tried to write this in the eligible course criteria here. So you say state, community, and online college, university, of course, that's the obvious. Then we said, courses offered by an accredited review training course vendor for professional designation or license.
Got it. Okay.
Try to be pretty broad. That covers a lot of ground.
Yeah.
Jackie, does that make sense?
It does. One thing I was going to ask Bart is my impression is that, like, if you're getting a professional designation and you're taking the review course, the fee to actually take the test would not be something that would be covered under this.
No.
Are you thinking it would be?
We could, but we need to add language to say it's one fee per test, because if you have to retake it.
Well, right, but I it's not clear to me whether the fee to take the test would be a reimbursable expense or if it's the expense to take the review course that's the reimbursable expense.
Let me get there. Yeah, I definitely agree that the testing is not mentioned in here. It's silent on that. And I'm looking to make sure we've described the course well enough. It's just, I think that the language here, Jackie, tuition fees for required course materials. I think that's, I see it as sufficient, but it does not mention testing at all. We could include that.
Well, I was just thinking, like, you know, when you take the bar exam, the bar review course is very expensive, and then you register to take the test itself, which is, you know, I don't know if it's now, but so I just think that's something if the committee wants to, you know, reimburse for the testing fee itself, then I think it ought to be explicit. And if not, I think that should be explicit as well.
I agree, Jackie. We need to have it silent and specifically state whether we're going to reimburse test costs or not.
Yeah, and I think we should, because that's a significant part of the cost of professional certification.
So if we took this area right here, lab fees, required books, and testing fees, would that be enough?
I don't see the word tested in there.
It's not there. I'm saying here.
I think adding testing fees would take care of it.
And I think you could also make another reference to it up there under eligible course criteria. You know, because we know, like, if you're going to take a college course, you're going to get a test at the end, and that's kind of all rolled into your tuition.
Right.
Maybe mention that in that second bullet about the professional designation.
And maybe here, right after a license, add a comma, including any required testing fees. So it'll just appear in a couple places.
Mm-hmm.
I'm topping. I hope you're writing this down, because I can't show it on screen and make notes at the same time.
Sorry, I was muted. I am trying, just don't have a hard copy, so it's...
Jackie is too, so she'll help me.
Yeah, you might, because it doesn't, I don't know if saying fees makes sense up there, because you're talking about the course, but you could say courses and testing offered by an accredited review.
Right.
Can I change that, David? I'm just thinking this. Courses offered by accredited review training course vendor for professional designation service and associated testing. And the reason I say that, that course vendor may not be the tester, and the fee will be paid to someone separately.
Right, right. Okay, yeah. And associated testing makes sense, just not testing fees. Yeah,
right. Okay. Yeah, so here we just be, we'll mention the testing, and down here, reimbursable, say fees.
Right.
Got it.
So one question, would it be clear that if I was not successful in the first certification test, do we need language specifically say the association will not pay for a retest if you're not successful on, like for the ARM, Associate in Risk Management, you know, there are separate tests required. Some people have to take, you know, one of those exams, maybe multiple times, but wouldn't be interested in paying for more than one, reimbursing for one test fee per specific exam, if that makes sense.
But the policy only reimburses if you pass, right?
Only if you pass.
Okay. All right. Got it.
So, Jackie, here, if we're going to put in something about testing fees, could we add a sentence there, or maybe another bullet that said any retesting?
Well, I don't know if that's necessary, because down below in the second to last bullet point.
Oh, that's right.
You need to pass in grade to get reimbursed, whether it's the first, second, or third time.
Right.
I think the thing I don't want is I don't want someone to pass it they receive a passing grade, now say, I won't be reimbursed the fees for the six times I took it.
Right.
That's...
Don't you have in there, though, you can only get reimbursed for a course one time, Bart?
I'm looking. Yes.
In the last bullet point.
Oh.
Yeah.
One course.
Okay, it's in there.
Okay. Okay. Now, can we decide on these two things? The percentage and the dollar amount?
My comment is 75 versus 100. I think an employee should have some skin in the game, to be honest with you.
Yep.
Now, there are some things that if someone was working on a bachelor's degree or, you know, 75%, I don't know if it's 75% across the board. If there's a specific certification or designation that the executive director wants to push the employee for, you know, I can certainly live with 100%, but, you know, I just like the employee to have some responsibility in the cost of a degree or designation that would prevent, that would benefit them in their professional career.
I agree, James. I like the 75% of the 5,000. Because,
yeah.
You know, I know those higher education expenses are just getting more and more expensive. So 5,000 doesn't really go that far anymore.
And that's per year.
Per year. David, what's your opinion?
That could be clearer, I think, because it makes it sound like it's. Oh, there it is, per year. I'm sorry, I didn't see it. I didn't see
per
it.
Year.
Per year, okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say the same thing, Robin, that if we go with a 75%, I still think we should pick the 5,000 limit.
Okay.
James, you agree?
I agree, yes.
Okay. Anything in the reimbursement agreement?
I like the 2-year. Retention requirement to get to be able to keep it all.
Okay. It sounds very fair. We can make those changes. Are you comfortable that we make those changes and while you move forward with the recommendation?
Yeah, I think that we should make the recommendation to approve the education expense reimbursement policy and amending it to show that it is to include testing fees in addition to the tuition and the books and lab fees. And I think we're all in agreement that the reimbursement would be up to 75% of the expenses with a maximum of $5,000 per year. And I guess we're talking calendar year.
The association's calendar year. Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
We should add that calendar year in there. We will do that.
Board, I had one question. I can't remember who's all on the call besides our councils, the board, and the lady from TDI. Are there others on the call, conference call, and Topping?
Topping and Jarrett, and that's it. No one else. I'll double check. Yeah, just the committee, Topping, Jarrett, Patty Otto, and then two council. That's it.
I did have a comment on the, as far as, I like the 75% and 5,000, but there was a clarification I like to ask in executive session concerning that.
Would you like to do this in executive session? Is it something you feel more comfortable?
No, I didn't know. I know we had some discussion about a staff member pursuing some designation, a certification, but I was thinking that amount was greater than 5,000. But that's the clarification I was going to ask.
I am checking.
But we can certainly get that asked and talk about it in executive session.
Okay. So let's just postpone taking any further action here. Okay. We can deal with this after executive session. We can have that confidential discussion.
Oh. And on item six, consideration and possible action on the association's whistleblower policy.
Okay, this was another one we've talked about a couple times, and it's been, we have a whistleblower policy, but it's somewhat limited to how we deal with anti-harassment in the employee handbook. And we wanted to make it broad as a whistleblower policy should be, to deal with any type of illegal practices, violations, retaliation, harassment, and from whomever those may have come, but we also want the employee to feel very open and secure into bringing something to light. So a couple of things, I'll go back and come through this. Whistleblower policy has been redrafted, and then I had shown you a schematic before, and you had a couple of changes there, and Jackie did a little cleanup on the schematic. What I'm spinning through right now is a redrafted whistleblower policy from the last one that was shown to the committee. And Jackie, you did most of the redraft. Do you want to explain the policy now?
Sure. Okay, so first we've started here with a purpose for what the policy is, which I don't think we had in our, well, I guess that's not, actually it's not in our policy. Sorry, started in the wrong place.
Yeah, go down to the.
Yes, okay, all right. So first off, we cover the reporting responsibilities, and the idea here is that it's, you know, intended to encourage and enable employees and others raise serious concerns internally to the association so that the association can attempt to deal with it. And then the second part is that everybody is responsible for, to take this seriously and to report any violations that they think might be existing. Then we've got a paragraph about complaints that are made in good faith are fully protected by the policy, even if it turns out after investigation that the complaint was not substantiated. And then that sentence there, any allegations not to be substantiated and have been made maliciously or with knowledge that they were false will be treated as a serious disciplinary offense. Confidentiality, so the association is going to use its best efforts to protect the confidentiality of the complainant for any good faith report, and then violations can be submitted on a confidential basis by the complainant, and they can be submitted to the director, the chair of the board, or board counsel. And then, there might be instances where confidentiality cannot be maintained because of the nature of the complaint. And so there might also be instances where law enforcement would need to be informed. Handling of reported and violations, they're going to be promptly investigated and appropriate corrective action will be taken as determined by whatever the investigation reveals. And then the idea is that the complainant will be informed on the status of follow-up activities within 2 weeks after the complaint has been received. And we've got a reporting procedure. So the idea is really if know, employees or their complaints get made to the executive director unless the complaint is about the executive director. It's the short way of saying that. So you've got the chart here. And so if it does involve the executive director, the complaint would be made to the general counsel, board counsel, or the chair of the board of directors. And then there's the investigation period. And, you know, that will really depend on what the complaint is about and how serious it is. And so that could be an internal investigation. It could be conducted by an outside third party. And then at the conclusion of the investigation, there would be a recommendation to the executive director or the board, depending on what the nature of the complaint, for a decision on action. And then in the resolution phase, you know, what the resolution will be decided on and then communicated to the employee. And if it's something where it's got sort of, you know, there's a reason for other people to know about the resolution, or there are further actions that take place as part of the resolution, then those things would be implemented and communicated as necessary. And then the big part is the no retaliation. So, you know, anyone who makes a good faith complaint is not going to be retaliated against in any form or fashion for making the good faith complaint. And then if at the very last of that paragraph, an employee who retaliates against someone who has reported a violation in good faith is subject to discipline up to and including termination of employment. I'll be happy to answer any questions anyone may have about that.
Very thorough.
I don't have any questions.
No questions.
Do we need a motion to accept this whistleblower, updated whistleblower policy?
So go for it, David. Second.
Okay, are we ready to move on to item 7, which is executive session?
And you'll have to read the language, and then Topping has to do a little adjustment in the recording after you read your language.
Okay, so we're ready to recess the regular session in preparation for the executive session. The time is now 1:54 p.m. on July 20th, 2020, and I am recessing the regular session of the Personnel Committee meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association in order for the committee to meet in executive session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act.
We are recording again in public session.
Okay. The time is 2:26 p.m. on July 20th, 2020, the executive session of the Personnel Committee meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association has concluded, and I'm reconvening the regular session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. Okay, so we do have one item that we need to take action on, we discussed in the executive session, and that is the consideration and possible action on adoption of the association's education expense reimbursement policy. And it's a motion to accept the policy with the changes to reimbursement to include testing fees, up 75% reimbursement up to $5,000 per association calendar year. Did I get that correct?
Yes.
Yes. So moved.
Again.
Okay. So it's passed then as amended.
Robin, you do have another matter from executive session. Let me get there.
Oh, yes, on the RFP.
Yes, ma'am.
So, right, so after discussion, it is the recommendation of the personnel committee. Let's see. Was that, is that it?
Well, there's a resolution there on screening and we can plug in.
I had switched to the different. Okay, here we go. Sorry about that. All right. Resolution on engagement of compensation consulting firm. The recommendation from the personnel committee to accept the proposal and engage Larson. Hold on, let me get the correct legal name.
Clifton Larson Allen.
Yes, Clifton Larson Allen to conduct a compensation and benefits study for the association's employees. I have a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. It passed. All right then. So now we're moving on to, that's everything we discussed in executive session. And now we're going to talk about item 9, consideration and possible actions on the management and staff training during 2020.
This is difficult because a lot of our training, we try to do some outside training and in-person training, and now we're doing a lot more in-person. This IR insolvency workshop was the last training we've done outside. I do an annual 2-hour HIPAA update that I require all the members of my Penn Treaty PACA committee to attend. And it's interesting, you think once you've gone through a couple hours of HIPAA, you've kind of done it and you don't want to see it again forever. Every year there's nuances and changes and they're tweaking that law. Legal seminar coming up at the end of this month. Jarrett and I are both be attending. Jackie, you're registered. Shelby, I believe you're registered. A little bit different because it's being done virtually, but that's going to be important training, and there are some good people to participating there. Cybersecurity training. One thing we do is it's required at least 1 hour of training to maintain our access to the NOLGA Quest system, and we've all done that. But through that training, through our bank, and through our cyber carrier, there's a lot of online training on some of the various threats that we can see in the cyber world. So we are doing some of those. I'm just not listing all of them. But right now, outside training is just not happening. We'll be doing everything online. Right now we're doing some training online, and then we have an in-person video conference training on Thursday on a new phone system we're implementing. So some of it's operational, but some of them are important to the task we're doing. So that's the training update.
Moving on to item 10, consideration and possible action on the committee's charter.
And here you can see on screen the last few times that we've made a change to the charter. We've had other changes to the employee handbook, of course, but this is just to the charter. And staff has been through it. We think the charter serves you well because you're staying very current on everything, and we have not identified any changes that might be warranted.
Okay.
that's it. It's kind of short and sweet.
Yep. Okay, moving on to item 11, consideration and possible action regarding the committee's 2020 calendar of activities and next meeting date.
I snuck in a date on you here because normally the committee would meet in July and January. Uh-huh. But with the RFP that's outstanding and with the engagement that you've just recommended, it would make sense to have a meeting sometime in October. This date is just a tentative date. It's the day before the board meeting.
Right.
We normally do those just to minimize on travel, but with the video conferencing, and I do imagine by October, we're still going to be video conferencing. We can pick any day that's convenient for the committee. And that agenda can be somewhat limited to hearing the report from the compensation consultant and providing recommendations to the board based on that study. So that's the reason for the additional meeting, is just to hear the compensation study, talk with the consultant, and any recommendations you feel is appropriate to forward that to the board.
Okay. So next meeting for the committee.
That date's fine with me. Monday,
October 19th. Yep, that works for me. Fine with me.
All right, sounds good.
Okay, and that's the last item we have for you today.
Okay. Anything else before we adjourn?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right then, the time is 2:34 p.m. on July 20th, 2020, and this meeting of the Personnel Committee of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association, it has been held pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act, is adjourned.